Ruth chapter 2. We're going to finish it out. We'll be starting in verse 14 today. And I'm going to have you turn a couple of other places too. Most notably, I believe, in the book of Deuteronomy, if you wanted to find it. But it's not far from Ruth, so you don't have to plan too far ahead. And while you're turning there, you know, you can learn a lot. I guess you'd say, broke into the ministry. And you guys know what I mean when I say that, because I declare all the time, I think, that all of us are in the ministry. I hope we all understand that, that there's not like, oh, the pastors are ministry and we just show up once in a while. Whatever it is that you do, man, the Lord has you in ministry. Like, you're to serve Him in all that you do as unto the Lord. But when I kind of went from being an engineer to becoming, like, this kind of became my job, career, if you will, I did that, most of you know, through the children's ministry. And a lot of you, that's where I got to know. I mean, I look around this room and I see tons of faces of people that have been helping me out teaching Jesus to kids for years. And it's just really cool, the relationships that we've had. And I'm really thankful for that. And those of you that work with our kids, you guys know this. You can learn a lot about someone having spent time with their kids, can you not? I remember being at Applegate one time, and I was teaching the kiddos, and I just asked for a prayer request. Be careful when you do that in a group of kids, let me tell you. And so I asked these kids if anybody got any prayer requests, and this one kid, no joke, said, and I knew who this kid was, I knew who the parents were. And the kid says, yeah, I have a prayer request. I'm like, oh, you, how are you, how about you? You're not in here, by the way, just so you know, it wasn't anyone in here. But the kid said, could you pray for Daddy? He drank too much, so Mommy made him sleep on the couch last night. True story. And we were all like, ooh, wow. Okay, that's enough prayer requests for the day. We'll just move. And those kind of things happen all the time. But you can learn a lot about someone by spending time with their kids. Let's take myself for example. All of you guys are going to go home and, like, train your kids, aren't you? Now listen, the things we talk about at home are secret. But Pastor Ed knows some of you guys real well. Anyway, my daughter, for example, Hannah, she just turned 8, which is just insane to me that my daughter's 8 years old. I just cannot believe that. I can't believe I've become one of those people that says, oh, time flies. I was never going to be that guy, but I am. And Hannah, so she's 8 years old now, and a lot of people all the time when they see her, they'll say, man, she looks just like you. We ran into some people at dinner just the other night I hadn't seen in a long time. And they hadn't seen Hannah since she was like 2. And they were just amazed. She looks just like you, they were saying, in which they meant good looking. And she is. So there's that. But I don't mean just that. I mean, that's something that's like ingrained in the DNA, and you can't change that. But there's other things too, that because of my time spent with Hannah and my interactions with Hannah, things that are kind of ingrained into my daughter that you could learn about me through conversations with Hannah. Just this week, for example, I started teaching Hannah how to play tennis. I love tennis. I played tennis in college. I used to teach kids tennis lessons. This is how I got through college half the way, and all this stuff. And so I love playing tennis. And so Hannah got a tennis racket for her birthday, and she's all excited to go learn to play tennis. And so we started doing a lot of that, and now she's all excited. She's going to be the next Wimbledon champion. It's just awesome. So there's that. There's other things. We both only hate 2 things on the whole planet, both of us, and you guys know what they are, but for those who might be visiting, we hate Satan because he's bad, and we hate Duke basketball for the same reason. And so we have, and that's it, and that's all we hate, you know what I mean? And if you were to go ask Hannah, what is it that you hate, she'd probably tell you that. I mean, and Bronwyn hates it that she says that, but that's 3 things, I guess. So, but there's other things. There's also character traits. You ever notice these character traits your kids start to pick up just from time spent around you that others wouldn't? Hannah loves to laugh. She is silly. She loves to tell jokes. She's been telling knock-knock jokes and things like that for years, and they're still not funny, but she thinks they're awesome, and she just laughs. They won't make any sense, and you just have to laugh, and she's just dying. She loves it. Loves to laugh. And I don't know if you know this about me, every once in a while, I like to be silly too. My wife and I actually fought yesterday about, not too much, you know, elbows and stuff, but no biting, about whether we should keep the movie Dumb and Dumber in our video collection or not. You know what I mean? And I won, guys. All right. So she also wanted to get rid of Cool Hand Luke. I just pray for her. Anyway, And that's Hannah. Hannah's learning things like manners and learning to value things like obedience and politeness and manners. And those are things that our parents, talking about me and my wife, they taught us and we've passed on to our children. I'm a Southern boy. You say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, and all that kind of stuff. And she's learning to do that. You can hear her from time to time even correcting Allie, our youngest, and stuff. She's getting some of that. Her personality, though, well, when I was in sixth grade, I had a parent-teacher conference, not the good kind. You know what I mean? And my sixth grade math teacher, her name was Miss Young, which was not an accurate description. She said to my parents, and I remember it to this day, she said, "Your son is a social butterfly." That's what she said. And she meant he's all over the place. That's Hannah. That is my daughter. In fact, movies aside, because she loves to watch a good movie, so do I, Dumb and Dumber. But she will be right by my side no matter what I do. I mean, we have the trampoline, birthday toys, scooters, bicycles, whatever it is. But if I'm outside doing something at the house, she's got to be right there. The social interaction between her and anyone else, and sometimes even particularly adults, she values so much. And I'm the same way. That's what I love to do. Also, though, she has a real deep, strong, we're starting to see this more and more in the last year that it's really touching and encouraging for us. She has a real genuine love for people, like genuine, like very sympathy for people and heart to want to give to people. She's always wanting us to invite the neighbors over for dinner. And whenever I mow the lawn, she would always say, "Well, you know, the house next door, we have a single mom on one side of our house and we have a 90-year-old man on the other side of our house." And so she would always say, "Don't you think we should help them? Don't you think we should help them?" So no joke now, every single time I mow the lawn, I'm mowing 3 yards every time. I just don't even ask anymore. We just do it. When the leaves come down, and oh, we have so many leaves. Now I have 3 times as many because we're doing leaves on there. But if I didn't, I don't know how to explain that to her, that I'm not doing it. It just wouldn't make sense. And it's awesome to see some of those kind of traits, things that have been maybe programmed into us from our own parents, see some of those things develop. But they're not things that I ever sat down and tried to teach her. You know what I mean? A lot of it are things that have just sort of come naturally, just sort of developed naturally over time. You can get to know a lot about a mother or father simply by spending time with that person's child. Now, with that in the back of your mind, I want you to look at the book of Ruth, beginning in verse 14. Ruth 14 says this. Ruth 2:14. "And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine.' And so she sat beside the reapers, and he passed over to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied and she had some left over." I mean, at this particular point in the story, things are going really well for Ruth. Now, if you're jumping in right now, you would think, that sounds good. She's hanging out with some people. She's having some food. She's eating until she's full. She's got leftovers. I don't know who this Ruth gal is, but seems to be having a good meal and things are going well. But we know that's not been the case for Ruth. That's a recent turn of events, if you will, as you're going through the story of Ruth. It didn't start that way. Her and her mother-in-law, her mother-in-law had fled Israel to a foreign land during famine. Her sons had taken on wives there in the land of Moab, Ruth being one of them. But over time, everyone in the family, her husband, her sons, they all died and passed away. And there was no one left but Naomi, the mom, if you will, in the family. And then there was Ruth, and there was another daughter-in-law who chose to go back and return with her family. But Naomi said, "You know what? I'm just going to go back to my home. This is just, everything is falling apart. I don't know what we're going to do. I'm going home back to Bethlehem." And Ruth, though she was urged to go back to her family, find another husband, find another family to join up with. "I'm an old woman. I'm not going to have kids. You have no hope with me." But Ruth was saying, "Nope, I am going with you." And in particular, in that exchange, she says, "Your God will be my God." We see that Ruth had a conversion experience, if you will, a time when she had declared her faith and allegiance in God and put every advantage that she could have had on her own in life to the side. No, I won't stay where I could get more a new husband. I know that going with you probably means I'll never have children. I'll probably never be able to do this and this and all those dreams that every woman has, just like every man, wanting to be a husband, wanting to have a family. I'm going to set all that stuff aside. I'm going to follow and be loyal to you and to your God. And so she comes back, and they come back and they're dirt poor. They had gone from wealth to absolute abject poverty, just total dependent on the welfare system that was in place. But poverty had not neutralized them. We've seen in Ruth that she's got a sort of go-get-it attitude. She's like, you know what? There's a welfare system in place here in Israel. I'm going to take advantage of that. We're not going to starve to death if I can help it. Let's go see if we can find some food. And sure enough, she goes, and there was a system in place in that day given by the law that we'll get to in a minute that would provide for people to be able to go to fields and crops and collect food along the edges, things that had been dropped as they were collecting harvest. They could go, the poor could go and take that stuff. And so she goes to do this. But just think, every single day as she's leaving home, before she gets to the field, and don't forget in our story that we're looking at here, she's still in her first day ever at Boaz's field. Those of you that have been tracking with us on this, this is her first time meeting Boaz and going to the field here, okay? So she comes to the field and she leaves behind a home that is marked with sorrow and bitterness. You guys remember Naomi, what she wanted her name changed to? She said, call me Mara, which means bitter, because the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. She felt, man, God has totally abandoned me. He's turned his back on me. My family is gone. My children are gone. My wealth, my home, prosperity, all this stuff is gone. I'm left with nothing. God has dealt, maybe she felt punished. Maybe she felt that she deserved this for abandoning the land that they had been given and promised, abandoning the Israelite nation and going off to this Moab, this land of Moab. So every day she's going to be leaving a place that's just marked with sorrow and sadness. But she goes from this place where all the loved ones are died, where everyone's in poverty. And I want you guys to really understand this, because a lot of times the story of Ruth gets pushed or emphasized more as like it's just this romantic love story, which it definitely is. But it's more than that. It's a story about poverty. It's a story about desperation. It's a story about where will my help come from. It's a story about a family that is on the edge of absolute devastation, being restored, saved, and rescued. So she leaves her house, sad, with Naomi there saying, "I'm just call me bitter. Don't even call me Naomi anymore. Go get the grain, whatever. God has dealt bitterly with me." And what happens when she gets there? Well, now by this time in our story in verse 14, the sorrow that was there that morning seems like just a total distant memory. I mean, she's come through and gleaned and been getting some of the food that was there, but then Boaz, the man who owns the field, checks with the servant and says, hey, who's that girl over there that's collecting all this stuff? Well, that's Naomi's daughter-in-law. That's the one that came back with her, has been helping take care of her. Her name's Ruth. Awesome. All right, hey, come here, Ruth. And he tells her, hey, look, when you come to get food, you stick around right here. I've told my servants they're not going to harass you. We can tell from his language that it was commonplace for the alien, and that's what she is. Remember, she's an alien. She's from another land. She's a foreigner. She's dirt poor. Ethnically, she's different than the people in Israel. And she's fair pickings. There's no husband, no brothers, no nobody to stand up for her. And so clearly, Boaz even sees, hey, she's really vulnerable. This gal is going to be in for all kinds of difficulty. So he says to her, you stay in my field. I've told my servants to leave you alone, not to harass you, not to mess with you. You stay around here. She's thinking, wow, not only, and remember, let me back up for a second. Remember, when she did leave to go find food, she said, and it's a key phrase, she said, perhaps I'll find someone who will show me grace and allow me to glean in their field. So even though there was a legal system in place that provided for them, clearly not everyone was observing it. She was hoping to just find grace somewhere. When within the legal code, it's what she had a right to legally. But she's saying, no, I just hope I find someone with grace. And so she goes, and sure enough, he gives grace, but it's so much more than that. He says, hey, you know what? You can hang out here with my workers. They're going to protect you. They're going to look out for you. And you can also, over here, when you need something to drink, you need some water, well, you can draw water over here out of these pitchers that my servants have already got. There's already water ready for you to drink. Everything's there. And so what has happened with Naomi, she's left her place of sorrow, and follow this, in hopes of finding just grace enough to just get by. That's all she's looking for or expecting, even hoping for. What she found is exceedingly and abundantly, as the word would say, above what she was hoping for. She wouldn't even think to ask for some of the things that Boaz is giving her. And she has been given so much more. She's given protection. She's given water. She's given food. They even tell her, hey, when she comes up to glean in different areas, don't rebuke her. If she doesn't stay on the boundaries where the poor people are supposed to stay, if she made her way out into the middle of the field, don't rebuke her. Leave her alone. She's found so much more than she could ever hope. But now I want you to understand something that's really key that I think is just awesome in this whole thing. Keep in mind and track with me on this. The law made a provision for Ruth to be able to get food, correct? God gave the law. In Leviticus 19, it says this. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right to its edge, neither shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor, for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. So the law states, yeah, it's your field, but don't take all the stuff around the edges. And as you're going through and gleaning it, don't just strip the whole land bare. If you drop something, don't pick it back up. You dropped it, just move on. They're going to be able to come. The poor, that's theirs. It was supposed to be ingrained into them that this was what's going to happen. But I want you to understand something about that law, and this is what we can miss. And this is a broad principle that, gosh, we could spend some time on this, but I don't dare without preparing more on that. A lot of times in Christianity, the law gets a bad rap. You know what I mean? Like we can say, oh, grace, and value grace, and we look at the law, and we'll take passages about how the law was the schoolmaster to push us towards grace, and all those things are true. But don't make the mistake of thinking that God's law is like this dark thing or this cruel, mean thing, because it's so not. When God gave the law to Israel, the context in which he gave the law to them was within his covenant promises. What I mean by that is this. He had just rescued Israel from slavery. He had shown tremendous love and grace to them, pulled them out of Egypt, fought for them, took out their enemies for them, brought them to a safe place. He's providing food for them. He's providing water for them. He had provided wealth for them out of the treasures in Egypt. He had given them so much. And then he pulls them all together and he pulls Moses up on the mountain and he goes to give the law to them. And he starts out the law by saying, I'm the God who delivered you from Egypt. He starts out the law by making sure that they understand, listen, I love you. I have cared for you. I am protecting you. Everything that follows in the law comes under that preamble. Just like when you as parents, those of you that are parents, when you have laws for your kids, it's not that we have rules because we want to be mean, or we're like, what mean rule could we have that will control our kids and just frustrate them? No. We love our children, and so we want rules to be in place. Hannah, I don't want you riding your bike in the street. I want you to stay on the sidewalk. You're so mean. No, I'm the father who has cared for you and provided for you and loves you, and I've been through this stuff before, and I have knowledge that you don't have, and so this law is there because I love you and to protect you. And that's exactly how the law was given to Israel. It wasn't given to them to frustrate them or to cause them to fail. This was a covenant that God made with his people saying, listen, and you can go through and read them from the Abrahamic covenant, but especially when you go into, even in Joshua, he makes this covenant, and I will be your God, is what he says to them. So remember that. When God gives the law to the people, it was intended to be an avenue of blessing for them. You understand? Not just rules to control them, but it was a means by which Israel would be blessed. They don't know how to govern a nation. They don't know anything about civil law. They've been slaves. They have no idea. What do those guys know about living in the wilderness and surviving? What do they know about even some of the relationships? I mean, they've been so controlled. And God's saying, look, I'm the one who created you. I'm the one who saved you. I'm the one who has loved you. And listen, this is the law that I'm giving you because I love you. And it will be a... And he, go through Deuteronomy 29, the blessings and curses. As you follow my law, these are the blessings that will result. So God's law was an avenue of blessing to them. That's really important to understand. And so here's what we need to know. For the law of God to be applied in the way that God intends it to be, and just track with me on this, and I hope I'm not going to lose you on this, but this is really good if I nail this. All right, so for the law of God to be applied in the way that God intended, it needs to be applied reflective of God's character. Here's what I mean. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 10. I want you to see this example for your own eyes. Okay, now what is the law concerning the poor? Don't take all the food from all the way around your edges. Leave that for them. Why would God institute such a law? In Deuteronomy chapter 10, look at verse 18. God, speaking of himself, says this. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and he loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you are sojourners in the land of Egypt. Now think about this. God creates a law for Israel to provide for the poor. Why did he do that? He did that not just to make people generous, because the end goal is not that Israel would just be generous people. God would look, oh, they're nice, awesome. That's not the end goal. The end goal, the purpose of having laws regarding generosity are right here. Because God executes justice for the fatherless and the widow and loves the stranger, the sojourner, the alien, giving him food and clothing. And then he says to us, therefore, love the sojourner. And then he adds on, and don't forget, for you are sojourners in the land of Egypt. So what does that mean God's doing? When God takes this law and gives it to Israel, his intent is that in the obedience of this law, recipients of that grace will learn something about God in the exact same way that the people of Israel learned much about God through their interactions with him. You see, he's trying to turn Israel into a living, breathing, walking, talking embodiment of him. That was the purpose of the covenant in the first place. God called Israel. You can go all the way back to Abraham in Genesis 12, Genesis 18, the Noahic covenants. You can see, Moses covenant. He says to all of them, listen, I'm going to bless you that you might be a blessing to all nations. This is where Israel messed this all up by the time that Jesus was on the scene. They started hoarding all the blessings to themselves. They thought it was all about them. Like, this is what God wants me to do. And so even though that in many cases they obeyed the law, they failed on the spirit of the law because everything stopped with them. But God intended them to obey the law in such a way that the people who were recipients of this grace or who observed their obedience to the law would learn something about God's very nature as they did it, you see. He was turning them into his disciples. That's what he's doing with Israel, right? This is not just a Jesus thing, having 12 disciples. God had 12 tribes, and this is what he's trying to do here. So he creates this law. Don't take all the food out of your fields. Don't take everything all the way to the edge. If you drop it, leave it. Put this thing into place to take care of the poor. Why? Because he wanted the poor, the strangers, the Moabite people who weren't Israelites, who weren't part of the lineage that came out of Egypt, who didn't know anything about God, to be walking through Moab, bunch of selfish people, don't give us nothing. And then they cross the border into Israel and they're like, and there is something different going on here. I mean, I can just take this food? And well, can I ask you a question? This is your field, right? Yes, it is. And that means that you planted all this around the edge too, right? Yes, it is. That's mine. But you're giving it to me. Why would you do that? Because my God is someone who stands up for the fatherless, for the alien. He gives food to those who are hungry. He takes care of those who will call out to his name. And this is what he did for us, man. We were poor. We were worse off than you, man. We were slaves in Egypt, big, powerful Egypt. And God just came out of nowhere and just his grace, he threw it on us and he pulled us out and he saved us. And you see this testimony would be unfolding. And so obedience to the law was not about polishing up people for the sake of polishing up people. Obedience to the law was so that as people would observe it and interact with God's children, they would learn something about that child's father. Does that make sense? You guys tracking with me on that? That's important to understand. Because as awesome as it is that Boaz is going to have a crush on Ruth, and as awesome, I hope I'm not spoiling the end of the story for you guys here. As awesome as it is that they're getting married and all those kind of things, that's the, and we talk about this, that's the micro level, like, oh, this romantic love story. But what is it about this? Why does this story appeal to us so much? People love Ruth. And you ask them why, and you'll get all kinds of answers. It's not because it's a romantic love story, although there may be, but hey, Song of Solomon is much more poetic. There's other stories that are much more adventuresome. I mean, when you really think about the book of Ruth, what happened? Some poor people went and collected some grain. The guy liked her. They got married. They all lived happily ever after. You couldn't really make much of a movie on that. There's got to be something more to it than that. And what we are seeing is that God is unfolding for us his provision to do these exact same things for us. Because isn't that what Jesus did for us? Came to us who were aliens, who were alienated from God by our sin, who were not deserving of anything, who had no rightful claim whatsoever to be able to say we're deserving of heaven. And yet because of the grace of the greater than Boaz, Jesus Christ himself, we don't just find, I mean, I say this sometimes when we're taking communion because it always just hits me every time and I don't know what better to say. We take the bread, and as we take the bread, we're often thinking about the fact that Jesus was broken for our sins, and we typically equate that to the punishment, like Jesus took the punishment that was deserved for us, and that is tremendous. But then he goes even beyond that, and he says, not only did I take the punishment, but now I have expunged your record. You are clean. Perfect. You have lived a perfect life in the eyes of God because you've been robed in my righteousness. And you're like, me? Clearly you're mistaken. No, I'm serious, man. Clean and perfect. You're like, that is way more than I could have ever asked or hoped for. And then he's like, and I'm so not done. There's this place called heaven. It's a wonderful place filled with glory and grace. If you ever heard the kids' song, and it's going to be, and it's just, there's just blessing after blessing after blessing, and it just piles up and piles up. And that's why on that day, when we come before God in the very throne room, when the Lamb having just been slain, when we see what happened to him to put us in that place, the Bible says that we will cast our crowns, our rewards for this kind of obedient behavior. He's going to reward us for that, and then we're going to see what he did for us, and we're going to, you're rewarding me? No way, man. This is all you. You did all of this, and we'll be casting all this stuff at his feet saying, we have been given exceedingly and abundantly more than we could have ever even dreamed. That's what's happening in Ruth. And so, what happens with Ruth? She's been given this water. She's been given all this stuff. She's discovering a lot about Boaz, but as this is going on, as Boaz is being obedient to God's covenant law, she's learning more and more about God as well. Because even though Boaz clearly has a thing for her, because he's about to go nuts with the blessings right here in a second, these are laws that a God who loves her more than he ever could instituted for her sake long before she was ever even thought of by anybody. So she's learning about God as she interacts with his child. You guys with me on this? Shake your heads, say amen. Okay, so what happens? Let's look at verse 15. And this is also important. Back in Ruth chapter 2. In verse 15 it says, so she rose to glean. And Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also, pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and don't rebuke her." And so she gleaned in the field until evening, and then she beat out what she had gleaned. She threshed it, got the waste out of the way. And it was about an ephah of barley. A lot of people argue over what that is, but one of the best descriptions of how much an ephah is there was an old Jewish historic writing that was trying to describe a vessel that was called, that vessel is an ephah, and he was describing in this old historic writing, and he said, big enough to carry the average man. That was the description. So you think bushels, something that even an average person could climb into, like this big, huge basket. That's what she comes home with. So he says, guys, not just the corners and the edges, but you know what? Every once in a while when you're bundling all this stuff up, pull out some of that really good stuff and just kind of throw it out there for her to just kind of stumble across. And when she picks it up, don't mess with her. And you let her get some of this stuff too that we've already bundled up. Let her take some of that too. He's just like, she has total free reign. She has every blessing under Boaz's field. Just as the Bible talks even in us. In Christ, we have every spiritual blessing in the heavenlies. And he's just pouring this stuff into her. And understand something about Boaz's attitude towards this. The law says to Boaz, when a foreign stranger comes through, you have to let them take the edge. And so Boaz is here in his field, and he sees Ruth, and he goes, hey, man, who invited the alien? Now we have to obey the law. Appreciate it, guys. Couldn't she have gone on someone else's field? Oh, all right. I guess I'll go do this and take care of her because we have to. That's not his attitude at all. His attitude is even above and beyond the very letter of the law. What he's exhibiting on huge display is the spirit of the law. He's reflecting God's heart towards the person, towards the one who's in need. Understand this. In our day and age, how does the invisible God express or make himself apparent and evident to people in the 20th century? How does the God who is invisible to those in the community around us express himself to others? It's the exact same way. Read 1 John. God's desire is that we, people of the new covenant, no longer bound under the performance anxiety, if you will, of the law itself, but now free to the grace of Christ, that we become the arms and the feet and the hands of others. When we talk about things like mercy or justice, when we talk about this Medford project coming up in July, all of those things, they're great. And maybe I've even misled you in some extent talking about how much God wants to turn us into generous people. He does want to do that, but that is not the end result, because wouldn't that just puff us up completely? Wouldn't we just become completely proud? Like, look how generous we are, man. We gave away all this and it would become about us. And that's not the intent. The intent is that as we go and do these sorts of things, not because the law commands us, but because grace and love compels us, we exhibit God to the people that we interact with. It's the exact same principle. Jeff, or whoever, why is it that you would come and mow my yard when you live over there? And why would you rake my leaves? And I can see on your face you hate raking your own leaves. Why would you do that all the time? And then I have the opportunity, God willing, to say, you know, there's a lot of things that I never had the ability to do on my own, especially, and I can start talking about, that's what the gospel is. Yeah, I can rake leaves, but I'll tell you something I can't do. I could never please God on my own because I know who I am. And yet, God loved me, and God blessed me, and God invited me into this covenant with him. And now, he gives me the opportunity to say, hey, Jeff, if you see somebody that's in need next door to you, go take care of it. Because as you do that, they're learning about me through my child. Same exact thing. It's an awesome, awesome opportunity that people learn something of our Father through their interactions and experiences with us. Well, so what is Ruth's experience then? What are the results of Ruth's interactions? Let's make a little list here. She's been allowed to glean. Yes. She's been offered protection while she gleans in the fields, yes. She's given water, yes. But now she's been given dinner. As we look through here, it says that she goes through and she ends up having dinner with them, that Boaz himself ends up even feeding her. So imagine this. You're Ruth and you're like, this is crazy. I can't believe I've got all this food. They're letting me get all this stuff. This guy is so nice and he's protecting me. No one's going to harass me. That's rare. This is so cool. And I can even get water. That's great. Oh, it's dinner time. All the foreigners, the aliens, wherever the sojourners, they're eating. I'm going to go over here with him. And then Boaz snatches her up and says, no, you come over here and eat with us. And she goes from that morning, leaving a house of bitterness and despair, to sitting with Boaz. He's feeding her by hand, as mushy and as that sounds to most of you guys. She's told, are you kidding me? Like, he's hand feeding her. Not only that, by the way, ought that not be the way people experience church when they come into contact with us here? That's why I was so blessed by you guys on Easter. People wandering in, maybe just hoping for an answer to something in life, maybe just hoping to appease mom who makes them come every Easter. Who knows what it is? And the next thing you know, they're being swept up. Hey, can we help you find a seat? Can we help you come over here? And instead of being over in the alien section, or instead of being over in the poor section, excluded from us, she's brought in. And look at even the heart of Boaz. I mean, it's thrown in as if it's just totally normal. He's sitting there eating with his servants. I don't know what you know about some of the ancient cultures, but that doesn't resonate as common. And yet here he is eating with his servants as if it was just this normal thing. And she's brought in. These people are just swept up into his company in the same way. And then she's being hand-fed so much that she goes from, I just hope I can find food, to, please don't hand me any. I love you, Boaz, but don't hand me anything else because I'm stuffed. I am totally and completely satisfied. And he's like, are you sure? I'm sure. I can't eat anymore. So then, okay, then the first doggy bag in all of history, right here in Ruth. All right? If that's what you're totally sure, I am totally sure. All right, then let's take the leftovers, presumably for Naomi, and they're all packaged up. And she is just more than she could possibly hope. She is buried in blessing. Absolutely buried in blessing. Side note to this, really quickly. This work that's happening here that is clearly an example of the gospel to us. Notice three things really, really clear. I'll say it in one sentence, but it's three specific issues. This crosses racial lines, this crosses international lines, and this crosses social lines. Ruth is separate from Boaz in all three instances. She's ethnically different. She's socially different. She's nationally different. There is nothing about her that would put her in common with. And yet here's Boaz eating with the servant, eating with the aliens. He's a perfect example of Philippians 2:3, considering one another better than yourself. He's not lording over them, but he's come in, even as Jesus Christ, who you know, I mean, maybe he could have put some plan together to save us from a distance, but instead, the beauty of the incarnation is that he put himself into the thick of it right there with us. And we see the same thing with Boaz, right there with her. And Ruth is now this poor, foreign, ethnically different woman under the covering of Boaz. And it's just important for us. I mean, I love history. I know several of you do, at least. It's important because understand, not even 50 years ago, there were people in our country that had to have separate bathrooms, had to have separate water fountains, had to have separate restaurants, separate churches, separate everything through a movement at that time that was largely Christian. Understand that. Because we can look at the civil rights movement that took place in the United States history, and we look at like Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and what he did, but what we don't notice as much in a lot of those stories is the role that so many churches played in trying to keep those laws of segregation in place under the covering of Scripture in their minds, and completely convinced that they were right. I want to show you something else in Deuteronomy really quickly. This is a total side note, but I think this is important for you guys to understand. I want you to look at Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 1. Deuteronomy 7:1 says this, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you're entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mighty than yourselves, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them, show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons." These three verses have been taken out of the context within which they're given and have been used to do horrific things throughout history. Segregation. Black people shouldn't marry white people. Well, the Bible says so right there. These cultures, he's saying, you stay separate from them. You Israelites stay pure and stay out of all of them. And their churches taught this and believed this because they did not take a whole account, a holistic approach to the gospel, and they didn't take exegesis, which says, what does the Bible say, and let's pull it out. Instead, they did eisegesis. This is what I feel. Now let me make the Bible say what I want it to say. Oh, check this out. What about verse 4? Forget about that right now. Let's just look at verses 1 through 3. See, you shouldn't marry black people. And that's what they did. But look at verse 4. "For they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. And then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you and he would destroy you." What's the issue? It's not that he doesn't want the Israelites married to the Jebusites. It's that he knew the wickedness of the Jebusites and that it would turn Israel away from God. Their issue was not social, it was not economic, it was not racial, it was theological. He was saying, listen, don't get mixed up in these pagan religions. Don't even intermarry into them because they will turn your hearts. And history shows that that was absolutely true. But Ruth is going to be in the very bloodline of Jesus Christ, and she's out of one of these very cultures. She's about to marry Boaz. So I don't know how, it's amazing to me how sin can blind us, how prejudices can blind us to say, but this is what it says, and that these very verses right here can be used to cause deep-seated hatred and segregation and prejudice. When then you turn to Paul, and this is, and you don't have to turn there, but this is, write this reference down if you would. Acts 17:26. This is the definitive verse on race relations in all of the Bible. Any race issue has to start with Acts 17:26. It says this, "And he made," this is Paul's words to the intelligentsia. These are to the smart people at Mars Hill. Paul says this, "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and boundaries for their dwelling place." He made from one man everybody. And so it's not like there was any separateness. They all came from one man, and then through one man, they all come back together and can be saved through the person of Jesus Christ. It wasn't that long ago. My dad can still tell me, I remember him telling me stories about Asheville High School when he was there and the colored water fountains. It wasn't that long ago. So anyway, looking on back in Ruth in verse 18, and we'll be almost done here. "And she took it up and went to the city." So Ruth goes, she had dinner, she's been hand-fed, there's all this leftover, she's got this big barley thing, she's gonna take all this stuff home. Verse 18, "She took it up and she went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned." She's carrying a huge amount of food home. She leaves the home of bitterness that had nothing, and she's coming home, and here's mom looking out the window, and Naomi sees her coming, and she's like, "What in the world? You stole. You broke. What? Where did you get all of that?" Can you imagine how excited Ruth had to be coming home? You ever have like one of those, I made a comment earlier about having a bad day. You ever have one of those really like crazy, miraculous good days, and you just cannot wait to tell your spouse. You can't dial the phone fast enough. You cannot wait to share that good news. No cell phones then. She's carrying all this stuff, but I bet you that much weight never felt so light as it did on her back, as she's like, I can't wait to tell her this. She's, your bitterness has been turned into bounty. You're not going to believe this, Naomi. So she comes home. Her mother-in-law saw what she'd gleaned, and she also brought out and gave her the food that she had had left over after being satisfied. This is the dinner that I had. It's already ready. You don't need to cook. And her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. The word kindness there is the Hebrew word hesed. I can't say those sounds very well, but it's H-E-S-E-D. And it's the exact same word used in the covenant blessings of God towards us. Man, he is blessed, this man. He is good. He is just. He is kind. And he has not forsaken the living or the dead. And Naomi also said to her, by the way, little side note, I threw in the by the way, the man is a close relative of ours. He is one of our redeemers. Goel, kinsman redeemer, which we'll break down in much more detail in the next chapter. But that's provided to be able to throw like, and by the way, he's one of our redeemers. There's hope in him. He's a relative. I remember him. He can save us, is what she's saying. And Ruth, the Moabite, said, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest. She's like, in addition to all of this, I got a job. Like, he's told me every day, you come here to harvest. I got work. We're going to be fine. But notice the key thing in here. Who does she say he said to stay by? The young men. Does your version Saul say that? It says, he said, stay by my young men. Now watch Naomi's motherly instincts kick in. Check out what she says in verse 22. And Naomi says to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his, what? Young women. With his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. Wise, wise, wise woman. She understands something of the culture that Ruth doesn't understand. She understands this practice of kinsman redeemer that we're going to see later. Ruth's still thinking, isn't this great? I've been given this and I'm going to get the same thing tomorrow. And Naomi realizes, oh, there's opportunity here for something so much. You still don't even understand what might happen or what could possibly happen to you out of this. Don't you go settle yourself for just some servant over there. You stay by the young women. You stay away from the men. In the next chapter, she's going to put this whole killer scheme and plan kind of thing into place. Like, there is so much more opportunity than here. And you're going to go, if you're not careful, and you're going to squander it with these young men. Don't do it. You guys ever had a conversation like that with your kids? There's a quote from he's a Scottish commentator 100 years ago, and he said this. What number of young persons take rash steps in the journey of life which cannot be retraced because they rather choose to follow the impulse of their own passions instead of asking and following the advice of those who brought them into the world. How's that for a quote? How many young people have an impulse and they choose to act on that rather than go into the very people who had even brought them into the world and asking, heeding the advice and wisdom from those with a little bit of experience? That's really good advice. Man, I'm learning so fast about how to be a dad. And I'm learning fast not because I'm like a smart learner. I'm learning fast because I have to, because they grow fast. It just goes that way. You guys know that. Most of you have kids older than mine, frankly. And I'm learning all the time. I even had a conversation with someone just this week about that book that we had bought all you guys, the parenting book, Give Them Grace. And it's a tremendous book. I cannot recommend it highly enough. But this one gal who's been raising kids for years, she was like, I thought I was a good mom until I read that book. And I'm like, no, that's not what I meant. That's not the heart behind that book. But I'm learning. Here's what I've learned. On my end, I've learned that I default really fast to legalism. You ever notice that about yourself? Daddy, can I do this? No. You ever notice that no is just the reactive phrase that comes out? And then you ever catch yourself and you go, I had really no valid reason whatsoever for saying that, other than maybe like my own hassle. Daddy, can I play with the balloons? No. Why? Might bother me. I don't know. I don't know why. I have no valid reason for saying that. And I'll find myself just defaulting to law, saying no, saying no, saying no. And so I thought about that today. And I thought about the quote that I had read regarding how God intended for his covenant law to be expressed to others. And it was this. So for the law to be applied, it must be done in such a way as to reinforce the character of a covenant-keeping God. Words by Alistair Begg, preacher out of Cleveland. He said this, if we are to properly apply the law of God, we need to first understand the heart of God when the law was given and make sure that we apply that law in the same avenue, in the same way. And I go, okay, so what was the heart of God when he applied law? The heart of God behind all those laws was always, I love you. I rescued you out of Egypt. I rescued you out of slavery. I have your best interests at heart. Therefore, and he wrote multiple books explaining and expounding the law. He's crazy patient with us, isn't he? Like he could have just said, don't do this. Well, why don't we do this? Because I'm God and you're not. Because I'm in charge. But he, when we take the time, we can see in all the laws God given us, we see his heart. We understand his motivations. We understand where he's coming from as he does this. And I just realize and I go, I don't always do that with my kids. A lot of times for me, I exemplify the inaccurate view of God's law with my kids. And I just go, no, because that's the rules. And in a sense, what I end up doing is pushing laws on my children that really just frustrate and control, rather than coming to my kids with a heart of God regarding law, regarding rules, regarding grace, and helping my children, even as I'm saying, no, you can't ride your bike in the street. Why? There's a gospel reason to that. Because you know what? You don't understand what that's going to do to you. But I have wisdom. I have things and experience and knowledge that you don't have yet at this point. And so even though you're not able to make a wise decision for your own safety right now, I'm going to step in. Now, it's difficult to explain that to a five-year-old. I get that. But we can get down on our knees and spend a little bit more time just encouraging and making sure that, yes, obedience is important, but it's not for the end that we have kids that are controllable. It's that we have kids that exemplify the heart of their father, that exemplify the heart of the Father in all that they do. Isn't that really what we want? Well, in closing, and we'll just read it, it says, verse 23, so she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of barley and the wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. But chapter 3 leaves you on a little bit of a, or chapter 2, I'm sorry, leaves you on a little bit of a hook. Okay, so yeah, it's harvest time, and she's got a job essentially during harvest where she's going to get all the food, all the protection, all that she wants, but harvest doesn't last very long. And so when harvest time's over, what happens after that? The writer kind of intentionally says, and so she stayed there till the end of harvest. But then what about after that? Oh, that's when it gets even better. But we'll get to that some other time. Let's all stand.